My name's Mackenzie, and I started a GoFundMe for the adoptive mother of a nonverbal autistic child. The mother had lost her job because she wasn't able to find adequate care for this autistic child. So she really needed some help with living expenses, paying some back bills. So I launched a GoFundMe to help support them during this crisis. And we raised about $10,000 within just a couple of months. I think that the surprising thing was by telling a clear story and just like really being very clear about what we needed, we had some really generous donations from people who were really moved by the situation that this family was struggling with.
GoFundMe is the world's number one fundraising platform, trusted by over 200 million people. Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com. This podcast is supported by GoFundMe.
Future Proof Extra
with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland
on News Talk.
Now, this is a true story. About 12 hours ago, I banged my head at a game of football against a side railing, and blood was gushing into my hands. It was quite a scary experience. And I went into the reception of the sports facility, and they gave me some bandages, and my hands were covered in blood. I was quite scared, and I put my hand over and held the wound closed until paramedics came. And paramedics came, and they said, look, it's not too bad. And they said, you should probably get it looked at. And I said to myself, they said it's not too bad. I'm not waiting in A&E for 8 hours. And I went home. And that in itself is a pretty damning, assessment of my experiences in A&E. And that, you know, that would happen, that you'd be advised by paramedics with a head injury to go to hospital, and you as a grown man with his brain working say, nah, I'm not going to do that because I don't want to be waiting for 6 hours and just be sent home. That says a lot. And so while we talk on this program about the wonders of medicine and science, the system, the health system that we interact with is deeply flawed at times. And we all know this. But how might we make it better? This is a question that Associate Professor in the Department of Women's and Children's Health at Uppsala University and Dr. Bot, Why Doctors Can Fail Us, author Charlotte Blees, has been exploring, and she joins me now. Welcome to the program, Charlotte. Good to have you on.
Great to be on, and I'm very sorry to hear about your injury.
No, it's fine. It's fine. Yeah. It's fine. I am fine. The paramedics were right. But like, it just says a lot, right? And so I wanted to ask you, because this is a really deeply researched book. It's like it's got loads of really interesting anecdotes about how things are and why they are. But you're a philosopher as well. So it kind of looks at the ethics and the whys of things. And I suppose I wanted to ask you, why did you write this book, and what were you trying to achieve with it?
Yeah, I wrote the book because I was really interested in thinking about exactly what you've commented on and observed in your own case. What are the problems with current health systems? And as patients, we're very alert to them. We know what they are. But what are the problems to which technology could potentially be a solution? So what I focus on is problems like what you've mentioned, access to healthcare. It's estimated that there was a study in the US in 2020 that found that patients take an average of 2 hours out of their day for a 15-minute medical appointment. And that's longer, incidentally, if you're on a lower income, because you probably have to take time off gig economy jobs and use public transport. So there's all kinds of barriers to accessing our doctors. But even whenever we get into the clinic, there are all kinds of psychological pitfalls that can kick in as well. And I talk about that in the book too, considering how people disclose their symptoms, how doctors keep up to date with information, all kinds of challenges there.
And let's start off at the very beginning of this, saying that to be a doctor is an impossible task, right?
Absolutely. My premise in the book really is to say, look, let's take seriously the idea that doctors are not gods. And unfortunately, we kind of, as patients, we tend to collude in this idea that they should be infallible, they should be omnicompetent and capable, and we feel let down when they don't get it right. But they are only human beings. They do have Stone Age mind wear like the rest of us. And if you put our mind brain in an environment that is incredibly frenetic, that is very demanding, involves a lot of multitasking, and involves a lot of keeping up to date with information. The way I view it in the book is it's surprising doctors get it right and are as successful as often as they are. Mm-hmm. So it's a huge feat of human achievement. But on the other hand, we've got to talk very seriously about the ways healthcare and human doctors who are doing their best can let us down. And we need to open up that conversation a little more. Mm-hmm. And that also invites a conversation about what's technology ultimately for. There's no point in having a revolution in healthcare if we don't know what exactly it's for. So that's really been my starting point for thinking about these issues.
Yeah, I love that opening line in the book where you're quoting some doctor and they said, I said to the patient, I'm not a god, but I didn't really mean that. Which
yeah.
I think it's just a great quote.
It's brilliant. It sums it up a lot too, because doctors actually do have to be confident in their decision making. And as patients, we also want them to be confident. You know, I mean, as you say, my background's philosophy, and nobody wants to go to a doctor who's sitting there umming and ahhing, and you know, you want somebody who's decisive. Mm. You also want somebody who's humble as well and can say, I'm not clear what this is, if they're not sure what's wrong with you. Mm. But what's really interesting is the older doctors get, and we do have an aging medical profession, about a third of doctors in Europe are over 55 years old. What that means is that they tend to be, older doctors are more confident in their decisions, but they're less likely to be accurate.
Is that right?
Yes, and that's because of the evidence base. The evidence base in medicine tends to be more or less fixed at the time at which you graduate. So the greater the distance there is from your medical education, and again, that reflects the challenges of keeping up to date with medical information, you have quite serious knowledge deficits.
Wow. So the research shows that you basically are almost, when you graduate, that's sort of how you think the body works. And even though you might be doing these upskilling, generally, most doctors don't keep up with the latest developments in medicine.
They just don't have time to do it. Now, that's not sort of a blanket assumption in terms of, you know, they're going, you can keep up to date in certain ways. But across the board, you will not be able to update your entire corpus of medical knowledge to keep track of the evidence as it's changing and accumulating. And medical evidence does change. There's a phenomenon known as medical reversals, meaning that the evidence for a particular therapeutic may change so that it's actually discovered not to be useful or in some cases harmful. So,
but I mean, surely there's some sort of bulletin or database that doctors can go. I mean, I'm assuming that happens, that you go to a doctor and you say, I've got this, and they check what the latest medicine is on this before they give you a diagnosis or treatment?
Yes, but a large part of what doctors do is instinctual as well. And when we were talking about keeping up to date, you know, in the old days, if you went to a doctor, they might have taken an encyclopedia or some sort of a medical textbook to flick through it. Nowadays, of course, they do use the internet. They will use Google. And clinical decision support tools, which have been designed for medical use, it should be said, those are sort of computer tools that give information that is supposed to be up to date, are very poorly used by doctors.
Really? But surely yes. ChatGPT has all the answers now. ChatGPT or OpenAI just released a version of the AI just for clinicians. Surely, you know, this gives them access to an enormous amount of information they can seek through, you know, obviously ChatGPT will make mistakes, but when it comes to medical science, it does, on the whole, a pretty good job if used by a medical professional, correct?
Well, this is where we're getting into interesting territory because then we, as you say, yes, AI in the form of these large language model chatbots is incredibly impressive. And doctors are using these tools in the US. I think one of the latest studies was about 2/3 of doctors are using AI daily. I did a study in the UK not published yet, but we got the findings. UK GPs, the study was administered in January this year, and we found a doubling in the use of doctors using generative AI tools, including actually mostly ChatGPT. So doctors are availing of these sorts of tools, which often are consumer chatbots, but not the ones that were formerly designed for the use, that were quite poorly integrated into clinical workflow. So what is really interesting is AI's already within the clinic without doctors being trained in it. They're just finding use of these tools. And what's really interesting too, of course, is patients use these tools as well.
So from a philosophical point of view, is there a danger that the confidence in the lab coat and the, you know, the GP surgery is shaking a little because patients can now go in armed with the latest scientific evidence, whether or not it's accurate or not, obviously is a problem, but we see advances, you know, bringing us closer and closer to a point where this information is going to be more trustworthy than your average GP. Is there a real danger that a patient comes to a doctor with the answer and the GP then has to fight against what an AI might claim, or just say, yeah, okay, I'll just write the script the AI tells me to?
We don't yet have the studies on that right now, but what I am seeing is a resistance on the part of the medical profession of patients using these tools. Yeah. So there does seem, it's almost a kind of paternalism 2.0. So there's the idea that, well, doctors know how to use these tools. They're the experts, so they can use these tools better than patients. And there's a fear that patients just can't master or command the information that is being thrown back at them. But unfortunately, that really doesn't work as an argument. And for empirical reasons, it doesn't work. We saw the same thing, two reasons. We saw the same argument arise with Google. With doctors saying patients shouldn't be Googling their symptoms and, you know, everything pointing to cancer and all the rest of it, and patients panicking. Actually, the evidence showed that patients on the whole, and there are going to be cases when people do worry more, but patients on the whole derive benefits from those traditional, what are now traditional search engines and Googling their symptoms. And we're pretty savvy and nuanced in understanding that Google might be not be giving them everything or that they didn't fully understand, but it still gave information.
Yeah.
So doctors tend to overstate the case here. Maybe a bit of an existential crisis going on in terms of competition. The second reason is we assume that experts will be able to work better with machines, but that isn't actually borne out by the evidence. And what tends to happen is experts can hurt the accuracy of AI, so they tend to be more averse to algorithmic output than lay people. That becomes a really sticky problem when the AI is giving a superior output. So we do have studies with, for example, ChatGPT even. If you pair ChatGPT with a doctor, you will not get as an accurate an outcome as if you just left ChatGPT to work out the diagnosis. We have several studies of it. Now, of course, these are experimental studies, but they do hint at a wider problem here that we really shouldn't ignore.
You know, I feel bad for doctors, of course, you know, that this is, it must be a tricky minefield for them to navigate. But if we're talking about better patient outcomes, which is what the whole healthcare thing should be, there must be benefits here beyond that as well, right? I mean, like, one of the things that I feel when I go into my GP, who is lovely and I trust him implicitly, but when I go in, it's a, hi, how can I help? And there's that sense of speed. I feel like I'm holding him back, I should, you know, and that, he's actually very good because he switches that off very quickly. But you do get a sense, you've got a short amount of time, you better get in, get out, because there are other people waiting. And that's a case in all health systems, because people are busy, they have a certain amount of time to see you and get out because they've got a certain amount of patients they need to see on that day. That leads to people not asking maybe the questions that they might not, you know, luxuriating and wanting to know a little bit more detail sometimes. And that can be problematic, right?
Absolutely, it is. And the way I frame it too, I take a kind of principle of charity approach, because a lot of the time the healthcare professionals will say, look, we just need more money in the system. We need better working conditions. Look, I agree with all of that. But the perspective I take is, let's say we have the kind of Shangri-La of medical centres, throw any amount of money at them within the current system, you're still going to have these human problems. And that is partly because when you're a patient, by default, you are consulting with an expert. You're going to see a doctor who has this expertise. And that tends to, if you look at the psychology of status, when there's somebody who's more subordinate in a certain context, going to speak to somebody who's more by default prestigious, people tend to be more deferential. They ask fewer questions. They want to be seen in a particular light. And they also sort of engage in a lot of impression management, which is quite an exhausting enterprise. Not quite the same thing as going on a first date, but you want to be seen well by your doctor. So that means that you might not admit to certain embarrassing or socially sensitive symptoms. I mean, domestic violence, mental health, such as severe depression. People take a long time to admit these things to their doctors, and they delay help seeking. And studies in the States show that about 85% of adults have admitted lying to their doctor, or at least massaging the truth.
Yeah.
That interferes with the doctor being able to do their job too. And doctors also tend to dominate the dialogue. They don't mean to do it, but again, that does tend to happen when you have that kind of psychological setup, if you will.
Yeah. AI is no panacea in this at the moment, right? And I do think we will probably get there, because I imagine good minds of and teams of both psychologists, philosophers and medics will get together and try and figure out, like, how do we make the AI better at this? And I do think we will get there with AI, but right now, AI has its own built-in biases because it was trained on biased data. And so it's not like the AI is perfect either. And we have to say that.
No, and I also want to emphasize that, my perspective and the perspective of my book is not to sort of have a love letter to technology. In fact, I want to move away from the idea it's all AI's all good or it's all bad. It's a much messier conversation. But you're absolutely right. The technology is the worst it's ever going to be, and it's going to get better. And the fact of the matter is, because you don't have some of those visual cues when you chat with a chatbot, people tend to pour their hearts out to machines. They are more candid. They'll interrupt the AI. They might, slag it off in a sense when they're chatting to it. And that is, when in a kind of a medical context, not such a bad thing.
Yeah.
Because the more candid and more honest and freer that you are able to extract information and discuss problems, that's going to be better. The big risk here, of course, is... well, there's a variety of risks, but one of them, of course, is you're giving away your sensitive health information to consumer chatbots.
And of course, the other one, which has been well publicized, is the danger of the chatbots then giving you information that leads to tragic circumstances, which we talked about in the program and people are probably fully aware of. So it's such a fascinating subject. There's so many things that we could talk about, but we'll have to leave it there. The book is called Dr. Bot. It's a really great read if you're looking to explore the medical system and also look for innovation. If you're one of those people who wants to see how to make a place better, there's lots of different aspects and pieces of data to consider. Dr. Charlotte Blees, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Future Proof Extra
with Jonathan McRae,
proudly supported by Research Ireland
on News Talk.